Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Feeding the Multitude. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. Last time we had considered the sad end of John the Baptizer because of the petty vengeance of the wicked Queen Herodias. And today we are considering the feeding of a multitude in Matthew chapter 14, verse 13. When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. So the Lord heard from John's disciples about his death. And when he heard it, he departed from where he was. And this departure was probably so that he could withdraw and grieve for this beloved cousin and servant of his. So he went off to a deserted place, a place where no one lived, by himself to grieve. But the multitudes found out about it. They heard about it, and the word spread. And so that seems though he went by boat so he could withdraw and grieve. Now the boat here is a ship, the Greek word ploion, which means a ship with a deck, not an open boat. And it's the same word used in Matthew 8 in the calming of the storm. Now in spite of the fact that he leaves by ship, the multitude hears about it. Word gets around. And so they start following him on foot. And word spreads to the cities along the way, and it seems people come out from those cities and follow along the shore and try to find where he landed. And it seems they succeed, verse 14. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. So when Jesus went out, and this would seem to mean either when he went out of the boat or else maybe when he went out of his solitude, where he had been probably praying and grieving, he saw this great multitude coming. Now he had meant to get away, and I suppose he could have been upset and annoyed at them following him, and yet that's not what he did. We read that he was moved with compassion. In Greek, this is literally that he was moved in the bowels. Although when we talk about bowels moving, we mean something very different. But see, they thought bowels to be the seat of the emotions. And if that thing seems strange to you, consider what happens to your digestive system when you're very emotional, and you can get the idea of why they thought emotions came from your bowels, your digestive system. So he was moved with compassion on them, and we read that he healed their sick. And it was as simple as that. He just did it. He healed them. He didn't have to start a show. He didn't have to pitch a tent and send out flyers and have the choir sing and get the people worked up and claim a bunch of people were healed. No. He just saw the sick and he healed them. And this demonstrated what people can expect when God's government comes to earth. When heaven's government comes, God doesn't share his government with illness and disease. He sends perfect health and healing to this earth. Verse 15. When it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food." So evening was coming. It had been a long day of healing and probably speaking and teaching to the multitude as well. And his disciples notice it's getting late, and they start thinking about eating. And they come to him, and they point out, "This is a deserted place." It seems that's where our word desert comes from, really, is deserted. But the idea in Greek is not so much of an arid, dry, arid place, like our idea of desert, but of a deserted place where no one dwells. The wilderness, as we would say, and not an arid place like a desert. So they were in a wilderness. No one lived around there. And they say the hour is already late, and I think they mean late for eating. It's already past the time when normally you'd be thinking about food. So their suggestion is to send the crowd away, the multitudes away, to go into the nearby villages to buy food for themselves. Now, since these nearby villages in this out-of-the-way place were small, and the crowds who had come to see him were indeed great, if he had done this, for many this may not have been a very successful quest, seeking food. Yet it seemed like the best and the only course to the disciples, since, of course, they had no means of feeding such a multitude. And we might wonder, why didn't these disciples anticipate that the Lord could do something about this powerfully, rather than just looking to natural means and saying we don't have them? Well, it seems to me that these disciples had gotten used to the Lord's quote-unquote normal miracles, the ones he always did, and those were the run-of-the-mill miracles you could always expect, and yet a new miracle would seem abnormal to them, and they wouldn't expect it. And these disciples had kind of a very different spirit, I would say, from Samson. Samson had been used powerfully by the Lord. The Spirit had come on him and given him the strength to tear apart a lion. He'd come on him and given him the strength to fight off an army all by himself. And yet he'd never given him the ability to do great feats of lifting. And yet when he needed to do one, otherwise he was going to die, he just figured, well, God's with me, he'll give me the power. He walked up to the city gates, much too large for anyone to pick up. Probably they would crush the human frame, they were so big. And he just figures God will give him the power to do it, and he did. He picked them up like they were nothing and walked maybe 30 miles with them and finished up by walking them uphill. So to Samson, a new miracle that hadn't happened before wasn't unusual at all with God with him. And yet these disciples didn't quite have the faith of a Samson. They got used to the normal miracles and were always awed and taken off guard by a new one. Verse 16, but Jesus said to them, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. So the Lord points out to them the obvious fact that they can do it. They don't need to send these people away on this almost impossible task, for all of them anyway. But the disciples didn't see this. They're so busy reckoning up the number of people. Oh man, this crowd is so huge. And then reckoning up the food. Oh, the vast amount of food it would take to feed so many people. Where in the world would we get this kind of food? And figuring out what they can do. Well, there's little cities and villages around, but we can never gather enough food for them all. We better send them together for themselves. So they're so busy thinking about these practical details that they forgot the most important detail and the most important fact of all. And that is that the Lord was with them. And nothing is impossible if we reckon with him in the equation. See, that's what happens when people in our day doubt the miracles of the Bible, is that they reckon without God in the equation, and they show their small faith. Verse 17, and they said to him, we have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. So here they go again, still reckoning just based on the natural, just based on the facts, leaving the most important fact, the Lord, out of the equation. So they list the food they have to try to show how impossible it would be to feed this great multitude with it. They say, all we have here are 5 loaves. And yet this word loaf isn't what we would think of as a loaf of bread, a big loaf of bread. This would mean more like a flat bread or a biscuit. The fact revealed by the Gospel of John is that these loaves they had were part of a boy's lunch. John 6:9, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. But what are they among so many? Well, of course a boy doesn't bring with him 5 giant loaves of bread for his lunch. He brings 5 little biscuits or 5 little flatbreads. And then these fishes were tiny fish. Something like a herring or a sardine. Maybe a tilapia at the biggest. But not a big fish like a salmon or something that could feed a number of people. No, this is a boy's lunch. These are tiny fish and tiny little biscuits or flatbreads. And so they point out, this is all we have to show it's impossible for us to feed this multitude. That's what they're thinking. Verse 18, he said, bring them here to me. And it seems to me that far too often, we are far too concerned with what we don't have to bring to the Lord, when instead, we should take what we do have and bring that to him. Let him have it, and he will worry about the increase. You think, I don't have much intelligence to give to the Lord to take into the study of his word. So you never start the study of his word. Well, give him the small amount of intelligence you do have and let him worry about the increase. Or they say, I have little talent for teaching in order to try to teach others about the Lord. Well, how about giving him the little talent you do have? Or I have little talent for evangelizing to try to tell others about my faith. Well, how about giving him what little talent you do have? How about letting him worry about making increase out of the talent instead of just worrying about the small amount you have? Because the fact is, it's about his power, not about your ability in the first place. So give what you have to the Lord and let him worry about the increase. Bring it to the Lord and he'll make something out of it. And he'll make something out of you, no matter how small you think you are. Verse 19, then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. And he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So he commands the multitudes to sit down on the grass. Now Mark gives us much more details about this, saying that the command was that they were to sit down in groups of hundreds and groups of 50s. And this was probably for the practical reason of making the distribution of the food easier. This would allow space for walking between the groups, rather than hazardous weaving around random haphazard people sitting around in the grass. Now the Gospel of Mark, which presents the Lord as God's servant, notes this detail that would be very important to servants. But Matthew, presenting the Lord as the king of Israel, well, the king allows his servants to worry about the details. And so it doesn't mention these details in Matthew. Makes sense. So they sit down on the grass there in that wilderness place where they are, and most know from picnicking, if you've ever been on a picnic, that sitting on the grass for a picnic can be quite pleasant. And that's what they're really about to do. So after they sit down on the grass, he takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish that the disciples had brought to him, and he looks up to heaven. And this is singular in the Greek. He looks up to the heaven. Could mean the sky, although, of course, it's symbolic. It means he's looking up to God. He's looking up to his Father. He's looking up to him in this situation. Then it says, notice not that he prayed, but that he blessed. Now, blessing is a word, as I've said many times, that is very nebulous in English. When we talk about bless, it's very unclear exactly what we mean. It would be nice to define it biblically, what the word blessing means in the Bible, and try to always think of that rather than our nebulous, kind of empty English word. But the problem with that is bless is used to translate 2 different Greek words and 2 different Hebrew words, which have 2 different meanings. And so, without looking back at the Greek or the Hebrew, you can't really know what bless means in any particular context. But in this case, the Greek word is eulogeo. And we get our word eulogized from that word, E-U-L-O-G-E-O. However, when we think of eulogizing someone, we often think of eulogizing them at their funeral. Or at least at some ending in their life, like at their retirement party, you eulogize their career. Whereas their word eulogeo just meant to speak well of someone or something, just to speak well of it. And so this means that the Lord spoke well of the food. He perhaps complimented the sun and the rain and the good crop that had brought in the grain made to grow the bread. He spoke of the growth of the fish in the water and the skill of the fishermen in catching them and things like that. The goodness of the food. Now we can sometimes, we call it giving the blessing. But really, I don't know that we think of speaking well of when we speak of giving the blessing before a meal. Or we could call it more literally or more meaningfully in English that we give thanks for the food in a prayer ahead of our eating. And that's good. That's a good thing to do, to try to be thankful. And yet I can't help but think that sometimes after we give thanks for the food, we then go on to speak poorly of the food. Oh, this doesn't taste good. It wasn't prepared well. Or I don't like this particular thing. I hate it. And this really calls into question how actually thankful we are for the food at all. Doesn't sound very thankful, does it? The problem is that in our society, we are so far removed from eating to live. You know, you don't say, well, I better eat or otherwise I'm going to die. No, that doesn't enter your mind. You just eat because you have a little hunger. You eat because your stomach's bothering you a bit. And you don't eat because you're close to dying if you don't. So for us, eating becomes entertainment. And like with most things that are entertainment, we rate it. I like this TV show. I don't like that one. I like this movie. I don't like that one. I like this sport. I don't like that one. And so forth. We rate our entertainment and we rate our food. And when you rate something, that's really kind of the opposite of being thankful for it. Or at least you're only thankful if it's something that you rate highly. And you're not thankful if you don't. So our thankfulness for our food is pretty questionable. And it seems that we have trouble speaking well of our food from the sense of being thankful that God gave it to us. Unless it's food that meets our high standards. But he blessed the food, even this simple meal. And then we read that he broke and gave the loaves to his disciples. Now this might seem strange to you, the breaking of bread. But the fact is that literally, that's what they had to do. Because their bread at the time was hard. It's not the soft bread that we're used to that is made by modern methods. They didn't have those modern methods back then. And their bread had to be broken. Like a cracker. Not cut or torn. Try to cut a cracker sometimes. It will just shatter. Or try to tear a cracker. It'll just break. And so their bread had to be broken. And that's what he did with it. Now Matthew just mentions the distribution of the bread. He doesn't mention the fish. But, of course, that isn't to say that Matthew's telling us he didn't distribute the fish. He's leaving that to our good sense. And if your good sense isn't quite enough, John 6:11 tells us plainly that they distributed the fish as well, and likewise of the fish as much as they wanted. Verse 20. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. So they all ate and were filled. And to understand this, we need to understand how many people there were, which is in the next verse. But there's something else we need to understand that I think many don't. And that is that these were poor people who were generally living hand to mouth. Israel had a very poor economy. And these people had probably experienced many a meal that was of a size that they only ate to stave off the edge of their hunger, not to truly be satisfied. In other words, when they were finished eating, they were just slightly less hungry than when they started. They were not full. They were not satisfied. And that was maybe a typical meal for many of these people, is that they were still hungry when it was done. Well, for people like this, and who had apparently been going all day without food, well, then when they're offered as much food as they can eat, think how much food they might have eaten. They might have eaten what we would consider as two meals worth of food or more. Of course, their stomachs might be somewhat shrunk by the fact that they don't typically get to eat that much. But still, they would have stuffed themselves until they had no more room to stuff. And the fact that there was any food left at all after these people ate, like I said, these people who are used to practically starving, and in this case could eat all that they could, the fact that there was any food left at all tells us that they ate till they couldn't eat another bite. So after they ate, till they were all satisfied, till they were all filled to the brim, well then they, meaning no doubt the disciples who distributed the food, took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now these baskets, the Greek word is that they were wicker baskets. And this word means a rather smaller basket than the baskets used, according to the word, in the feeding of the 4,000. It was a somewhat larger basket. Now there are probably 12 of these smaller wicker baskets, because each disciple of the 12 carried a basket. And then they filled these baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now when you consider that these 12 baskets were filled from what was originally 5 loaves, like I said, biscuits or flatbreads, and 2 fish, 2 small fish like a herring, These baskets were filled from the fragments that probably originally, before the Lord divided them, would have barely covered the bottom of one of these baskets. You can see what a great miracle this was. And I wonder, what did this look like while the Lord was doing this? Did he have the food in the basket, and he'd pull out a loaf, and then another, and another, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, he keeps pulling them out, long past the five that were originally in there? Or did he pick up a biscuit or a flatbread and tear it, and the piece he tore off was bigger than the original flatbread he'd torn it from? And he distributes it, and he tears off another piece, and that one's bigger than the original flatbread. And he keeps tearing, and he tearing and tearing, and the pieces keep being bigger than what he tore it off of. Well, I don't know what it literally looked like, but here in the aftermath, we can see what a stunning miracle it was. The Lord indeed multiplied this food. Verse 21, now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So here we have the number of men who ate. And the word men is the Greek aner, A-N-E-R, which means an adult male. It's a male particularly. Now this is probably mentioned not to be sexist or something like people always tend to think today whenever men are mentioned, but probably because these were male heads of household. And so they were divided not into groups by individuals, but groups by households. So the groups of 50 were groups of 50 households, not groups of 50 individuals. Now, if we would assume a female for each male, which there may not have been if the men came out and didn't necessarily bring their women with them, but if we assume a female for each male, that doubles it, and then a number of children, and the word children here means underage minors, not adult children. But when we consider this, this adds up to probably well over 10,000 people. This was a great crowd indeed, fed from this small amount of bread and fishes. And what a miracle this was. Now this, like all the Lord's miracles, was a foretaste of the kingdom of God. And Psalm 145 and verse 16 says, of God and the kingdom, you open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. And the fact is that that's how it's going to be in God's kingdom when God's government comes to earth. Is he is not going to share his government with a lot of hunger and starvation and people going to bed at night not having enough food, and children without enough food, and so forth. No famines in God's government. He's going to open his hand to satisfy the desire, and not just of every human being, but of every living thing, the desire of all the animals. No more of this fierce competition for limited resources. Every living thing is going to be satisfied. And the Bible picturesquely describes it as the fact that the reaper will overtake the sower. The harvester will overtake the planter. He'll catch up to him. He's still planting the seed, and the harvester is catching up to him. Well, I think that's an exaggeration, of course, but it's an exaggeration to prove a point as to just how amazing and staggeringly fertile the earth will be in God's government. And this demonstrates it. God will multiply the food on earth, and we won't have to worry about limited resources. That all will be fed, that all will be taken care of, that God's government will not be like human governments, that it will successfully feed not just every human, but every animal, every being on earth. What a government that will be. So we see in this portion that the Lord was not limited by the laws of nature that he put in place. When he chooses to open his generous hand, there will be no shortage of food. And in his kingdom, no shortages like a food will plague men. No hunger will exist on earth. Our Lord Jesus demonstrated this in his powerful feeding of the multitude. Yet they failed to learn obedience to him. Do we learn the same lesson? Do we trust that God's future kingdom will indeed satisfy the needs of all on earth? Well, it will. And let's trust it, and let's believe it.
What a beautiful example of what mankind can expect when the kingdom of God becomes a reality upon this earth. No hunger, no lacking, no need going unmet. When God governs the world, we can trust God for all of our needs. Until that day, we can trust the God who made those promises. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on feeding the multitude. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Lord of the Sea. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that the more you study God's Word, the more you know and love God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also send out a weekly email newsletter in which Nathan does the same thing he does on this program, going verse by verse through the Bible and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on this mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although we always appreciate your financial support, you will never be solicited for funds in any way when you write to us, so feel free to contact us. This program has been brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry. I've been your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now. We look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.